is Red Eyes Radio. Welcome to Red Eyes Radio, my friends. This is Henrik Palmgren, your host and editor of the website red-eyes.net. I'm coming to you from the west coast of Sweden, either through bbsradio.com or if you're listening to this program from the archives. But wherever or whenever you are, thank you for tuning in. And today we have a very special guest on the program. Richard Hamlin is with us, and he's actually calling us from Placeville County Jail in California. And what we are going to address today is a very, I guess, disturbing issue or topic. And I have in the past on the website highlighted and posted similar stories and articles in regards to many of the things that we'll be addressing here today. And a few of you might remember that I've posted a few articles about Richard Hamlin. The last one was in the beginning of July, so if you have been following along, you will be familiar with some of the things that we'll be talking about. I will also make sure to have related articles linked from the info page about this program, so you will be able to follow along and also visit Richard's website and so forth. A while back, I was contacted by Richard, or by Richard's attorney, I guess, and I thought that it would be a great idea to do a program about this and let Richard himself talk more in depth about this case and what has happened to him and his wife. And I can also mention that we talked over the phone last week, and I can say that my impression of Richard is that he's an extremely courageous man who has, for the love of his children, pursued this case where the evidence have led him, and he have kept an open mind along the way, and where many others would probably have turned away, Richard have allowed himself to explore much of the available research that is out there in order to understand and get to the bottom of this bizarre and awful world of mind-controlled child molestation and satanic ritual abuse that his wife was or maybe even is a victim of. And this is an important case and an extremely important issue to dare to address and face. And wherever it might lead, it needs to be sorted out, and the implications could be enormous if we find that this kind of thing is more commonly spread around the world than we first believed. It could be, in one way, maybe explain a lot of things, but it would also make this world a whole lot stranger and scarier. But we would definitely know that there are serious issues to deal with on this planet. And I will let Richard now talk more about this, so let's bring him on and say hello, Richard, and welcome to the program. Let me say it's great to have you here and that you could make time to be with us today. How are you holding up, my friend?
Well, I'm doing all right, and I just really appreciate you doing work like you're doing. I think it really helps get the word out. I was somebody that, when I first started all this, didn't really know anything about mind control or type of ritual child molestation that I've discovered, and yeah. Resources like yours really help, and I just appreciate it greatly that I'm able to give you a call and talk about this.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you very much, and as I said, it's great to have you here, and to start things off, why don't we begin at the beginning so everyone is able to follow along? There are quite many threads to sort out here, so I mean, if you can basically outline for us what has happened to you and your wife, and why you now are in jail. And I also want to say that take as much as time as you feel is necessary. We've got about, 15 minutes or so here, so please go ahead, Richard.
All right, thank you. Well, how all this started was, I was married to my wife, and her name's Susan Hamlin, and we had been married for a number of years. When I was arrested, we'd actually been married up to 20 years. And what happened was this. She basically showed some signs that something, was wrong from her childhood. Now, I was just a guy, and I didn't pick up on a lot of these things. But what I now know is that, these symptoms start to grow. She started becoming more depressed, a lot more very significant mood swings. was almost like there was a toxin inside of her that needed to get out. And for the most part, you know, Susan, you know, tried to describe her life as kind of picture perfect. You know, she was almost robot-y that way, you know. Everything was just fine. But things started breaking down emotionally for her. And, you know, you'd ask what it was, and she just wouldn't really be able to articulate it. One of the big red flags was that she had major blocks of memory gaps throughout her childhood. So in trying to talk to her, it was even more difficult because she had these huge gaps, I mean, whole periods of time that were just blank. And as things went on, it finally got to a point where I really thought that I needed to kind of cut back what I was doing in terms of my profession. I was a criminal defense lawyer. Before that, I had been a prosecutor, and I had been very involved in my work. But I just, what I saw was a woman that was in free fall as we were approaching the end of 2002.
Yeah.
And so I just really decided to kind of cut things back and really start paying attention to what was going on and try to explore some things. And she had been approached by another member in her family, her sister, and her sister had thought that they had been victims of being molested by her father.
Yeah.
And slow but surely, we started, you know, just working on facts that she knew. And what ended up happening was she started to reveal her history. It started off by her telling me about a girlfriend that was molested by her father. And she was really kind of stuck on that. And one night, as we were going through, you know, just going over some memories that she did have, she decided to look at a photo album. And she dug this out of a place I had never seen these pictures before. And she flipped through like 2-3 pages, and then she just froze. She saw a house that she had totally blanked out, never told me about. And she started to tell me where this was. And I was very surprised because, you know, I had known where she had lived, and she had never mentioned this.
Yeah.
And she just looked off into space, and I remember she said, "I blanked this place out because bad things have happened there." And that is what really started an avalanche of memories that started coming out. And when you're dealing with somebody that has repressed these memories or has actually suffered from multiple personality disorder, they don't come out free-flowing. They come out in bits and pieces.
Yeah.
You have like 2 steps forward and 1 step back. You know, for 2 days she wants to let it all out, and then, you know, one day it's like another personality takes over and she's extremely protective of the perpetrator.
Yeah.
Doesn't want to reveal it. And to sum up, what ended up coming out, and this was all through the year 2003 up to my arrest, which was February 28th of 2004, she revealed perhaps the most horrific childhood that I had ever heard of. She had been raped incessantly from 2.5 years old on throughout her life, even after we were married, by her father. When she was young, he was part of a larger group that molested children, and she was passed around to other adult family members and to other associates of her father. Her father's name is Dr. Sidney Seymour. And what we had found about him was that he was part of a larger organization group that basically kind of swapped kids. And some of the things that they did to instill trauma was that they did some of this abuse during satanic ceremonies.
Yeah.
And for a year, she started to pour these things out, and she started writing diaries, and she started finally feeling courageous enough that she actually confronted her father about much of this. And the things that she wrote about are just mind-boggling. She wrote about being brainwashed and hypnotized and different forms of mind control and the things that were done to her to keep her in line and to basically keep her silent are just stunning. And at the time, like I said, I had never heard of anything like this.
Yeah.
And through talking with people like Dr. Colin Ross, who's internationally renowned about multiple personality disorder and about severe trauma that happened in childhood, I've been able to put together the pieces of this puzzle. But up through 2003 and 2004, I was just trying to be a husband that was helping his wife.
Yeah.
We finally got to a point where she actually was going to go to the police, and that was something that obviously I thought had to be done.
Yeah.
And she did go to the police, gave a full statement. That is actually recorded. As a matter of fact, one of the summaries, case summaries, is on my website, which is at geocities.com/RichardWHamlin, and you can actually see the actual summaries that she gave. And they're horrifying
that
she's claiming it took place. And the police hearing these things I'm out in El Dorado County in California, a small, very well-to-do county, and they haven't heard of things like this. And their reaction was somewhat disbelieving. I mean, she was talking about a great number of people that were involved. The type of mechanisms that they were using to keep the silence was stunning.
Yeah.
Things that she saw included a murder of a young girl. And they, you know, were just a little bit disbelieving immediately.
Yeah.
And I think she began to panic. And two days later, she recanted and said that I beat her to make these statements. And that's why I'm in jail. And Dr. Colin Ross has testified about this and has said that it's very, very common what she has done. And what complicated matters was that when I took her down to the police station, and she did have bruises on her, and she described for the police what had happened. An associate of Dr. Seamer's actually beat her up, and was a last-ditch attempt to keep her from going to the police. What has been revealed here would end up, you know, sending him away for the rest of his life, along with some very, very powerful associates of his.
Yeah.
So in an overview, that's basically what happened, and she has held on to that recantation through this, and what we try to do is prove independently that these things have taken place, and I think we've been very, very successful in that regard.
Yeah, and the initial response from the people who can't, you know, who might not understand this kind of, you know, how this would work, or even doubt that this have been done before. I mean, in your case, have you been so far referencing back to historical events that obviously bring up this, like MKUltra and such?
Yes. And I'm glad you raised that, because I think to have a better understanding of this, that's where you got to start to look.
Yeah.
In our country, we've had some very corrupt things that have happened. And believe it or not, they've actually been made public, and yet at times I think it's so horrifying that the public wants to kind of sweep it under the carpet.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, one of the questions I had when I was going through this, I mean, if you can imagine this, you know, I've been married to this woman for 20 years, you know, very successful career, wife, also as a lawyer, you know, we had four beautiful children. We had the house of our dreams. Everything seemed idyllic. But this can't come on. And I'm talking to friends about this, and their first reaction is, well, you know, you got to leave her. I mean, obviously, if she's doing, you know, incestuous acts with her father after you were married, I mean, she wanted to do this, you know.
Yeah.
And I inherently knew that just wasn't the case. There was something more to this. Mm-hmm. I mean, I, you know, this woman seemed to have very different personalities, and it seemed as though there was somebody struggling to try to almost get out.
Yeah.
And so I started researching and tried to, you know, make some sense of this. And what I have found through our research is that there are lots of victims, like my wife, Susan Hamlin, and there's lots of perpetrators like Dr. Sidney Seamer. And basically, what I have put together is that my ex-father-in-law, Dr. Seamer, was involved with MKUltra. He was in the U.S. Army during the Korean War. And basically, after he supposedly got out, he basically was told to that he was wanted in continued intelligence work. He had been in military intelligence during his time in the Army, and basically he worked his way up and began being involved in this program. And the reason that we can say that, we've had some independent witnesses through our two-and-a-half-year investigation that have come forward that have linked him with biological warfare work that he was doing. And we've talked to several other witnesses.
Yeah.
We've just kind of gone through his background, and it fits perfectly with MKUltra.
My God.
Some of the things that MKUltra covers is this. The basic, I guess the goal that they set out to do was change people's behavior through several mechanisms. One was through mind control and different trauma-induced events.
Yeah.
Another was through radiation experiments. And then the last was through biochemical agents being applied to folks.
Yeah.
And under that umbrella, they had a multitude of different programs. Under MKUltra, that is where the Manchurian Candidate basically was.
Yeah.
They wanted to have spies that would be able to be captured and not give up information. And what they discovered was, in order to do that, if they could induce enough trauma that the mind breaks off into separate personalities, and then they can actually work to trigger those personalities to bring them back up. And
this,
you have a spy that's sent out,
yeah.
And he has been basically through a trauma-induced state created multiple personalities. He goes off and he's just John Smith. He's an insurance salesman. He's just somebody that, you know, that's what he believes his life is.
Yeah.
And then if he is triggered, he goes into his spy mode and is able to carry out the directives that he has to carry out.
Yeah.
Once he gets it done, he goes back into his regular life, John Smith, and if he's captured, that's all he knows. He just thinks that's what he is. So that was basically was the genesis of MKUltra, was to try to create a mechanism for spies and whatnot not to give up information,
yeah.
And also for the extraction of information from enemy spies.
Yeah.
Under that program, it's just like a bunch of warped kids. They started to think, well, what else can we do in terms of affecting people through their mind and through other agents?
Yeah.
And that's when MKUltra began to grow and spread.
Yeah.
Now, if you told me about MKUltra, you know, 5 years ago, I would have said this is some conspiracy story that really had no basis. But
yeah.
The one thing I would alert anybody that is interested in this topic, this was actually raised before senatorial hearings in 1975 and 1977.
Yeah.
And they, the church hearings in 75, and then Ted Kennedy headed up the 1977 hearings. And this was made public record. You can get on the internet and actually get the transcripts from these hearings.
Yeah.
And what came out at these public hearings is just horrifying. They condemned the projects. They were using unwitting participants to experiment on. And they created a big splash and then kind of died away.
Yeah.
But the question they did not ask was for these people that were trained up with these abilities to affect other people's mental abilities, did they ever do anything in their private life from their training that we should look into?
Yeah.
That's one question that has not been asked. The best example I can give is if they taught you how to make a nuclear weapon and then they just sent you out into public and didn't watch you. I mean, basically,
yeah.
Dr. Seamers of the world have been given the ability to blow up a person's mind
yeah.
and control them
hmm.
to a certain extent, and there's been no, you know, watching what they do in their own civilian life.
Yeah.
So for a person that wants to have basically perfect little sex robots that are his own kids,
hmm.
you know, knowing what he knew really
hmm.
makes it a formidable defense to ever catch him.
Yeah.
He's got people walking around in these stupors where they, you know, there are these amnesic walls that are meant to protect the poor child's mind,
yeah.
at the same time protects the perpetrator.
Yeah, that's
it's just devastating.
Yeah, let's address that a little bit. I don't know how much you actually know about this process, but as you say, this is a defense mechanism that happens in the brain when a person is, involved in these kind of traumatic experiences. I mean, can you elaborate on this?
Well, and you know, I've learned a great deal over the last 3.5 years. I've been in jail for just about 2.5 now, and I hadn't really delved into this subject during that year, but I got to hear everything from my ex-wife.
Yeah.
And so putting the two together, I've been able to kind of figure some things out.
Yeah.
And plus, I've worked very closely with Dr. Colin Ross, and I'll tell you, he's just a fantastic man. Bottom line is, a lot of this isn't really some kind of, you know, voodoo or anything else. It's just the basics of the mind.
Yeah.
Where people like Dr. Seamer, they start with a child that's very young. And what happens is a traumatic event like being molested or being raped as a child is so traumatic that the mind simply cannot deal with that. They've got to do something with this traumatic memory. And this is the same thing that would happen to somebody that had seen something awful in war, a bad mugging even, as
yeah.
an adult on a singular case. The mind has to do something with that.
Yeah.
And for some, on a singular event, doctors will talk about the person seeming to float outside their body and look down. It's like it's happening to somebody else.
Yeah.
But if this event continues to happen, the mind needs to do something more. Because if they didn't, these children would simply die. They would. It's like an implosion.
Yeah.
They could not handle that kind of trauma, and they couldn't understand it.
Yeah.
So what happens is the mind starts breaking off and making separate personalities. So my ex-wife, Susan, for example, as she's going through this molestation and being raped, the child mind starts to break off and puts these events in a different personality. When
yeah.
she comes to, they call it the walking self, she doesn't remember. Now, that's great for her protection, right?
Yeah.
But it also is great for what? The perpetrator.
Exactly.
Because she's not remembering that event.
Yeah.
But what starts to correspond with that are large blocks and memory gaps, and then you start to see other things. The subconscious is aware of what took place, even though the walking self isn't. So as the person grows and develops, they start to show certain signs. For example, many people that have been victims of this and don't have active recall will have thoughts of killing themselves, suicide from very young.
Hmm.
They have deep bouts of depression that increase as they get older.
Yeah.
They have self-esteem problems. They usually have sexually related problems. They're either overly promiscuous or very frigid.
Hmm.
They usually feel that sex with men is bad if they've been a female child that has gone through this.
Yeah.
And my ex-wife exhibited all these things. She's actually reported that she thought about suicide for the first time when she was in kindergarten. And I just ask, you know, the audience to think about that. You know,
yeah.
If you have kids or even on your own childhood, what child would think that killing themselves at 5 years old is a better option than what they're living through? Something very, very traumatic has to be going on for a child to be in that place.
Yeah.
And we actually ran down and an investigator talked to her best friend that was in elementary school. We found her and actually interviewed her. She confirmed that Sue would talk about suicide as early as fourth grade. So it wasn't a fleeting thought. It continued on.
Yeah.
And that was because of what was going on. And to finish off this process, what happens is, as a youngster, if you are breaking off into separate personalities, well, then as you get to become an adult, it happens much easier. And people that have gone through this kind of trauma are highly susceptible to being hypnotized, and it can fall into trance states extremely easy.
Yeah.
Some correlation to that, and I can't tell you the reason why, but study after study says that, that is something that happens quite easily. And Dr. Seymour was a student of hypnotism through his work in the Army, and in one of the reports that my wife gave to police, said that her dad taught her how to put our kids into a trance state in order to molest them.
Hmm.
And that's you know.
Yeah, and
the horrifying thing about this, and part of the reason I feel compelled to talk about this, is these poor people that are victims need to be found, and they need to get some help. And once they can deal with what happened, and it can come out, and they can actually start to talk about this and realize what happened, health can be attained. It really can be.
Yeah.
But if they are not addressed and found, the numbers overwhelmingly are that these victims will morph into perpetrators. They will become the very thing that they hated. And in my case, my wife actually molested, with her father, my four children. And I don't believe she did it for sexual reasons or anything else like that. I believe it was under his duress and control.
Yeah.
But on the same hand, she allowed it to happen. And this is the tragedy that will play itself out over and over and over again, generationally, until we stop it.
Yeah, and
we've got to.
Yeah, and we talked about this last time we talked, that there must be an incredibly powerful manipulation involved here if you're able to, you know, bypass a mother's, you know, maternal instincts to protect their own children and allow this behavior to go on. And this shows you just how, you know, powerful this kind of technique seems to be.
I had a huge problem with this, and at first I didn't understand it. And then after stepping back and away from it and talking to some experts, you know, they made it kind of simple. And it's this: she can't protect herself. She's never been able to protect herself. So how in the world could she protect me? How in the world could she protect her own children?
Yeah.
And it is. It's such a foreign concept to think that a mother would allow the very thing that has terrified her, ruined her life, to happen to her children. And this is the kind of, you know, manipulation control that this man had over her. And I'm talking about literally, you know, he could give a phone call, and my wife would be up, she'd be, you know, the Sue I knew.
Yeah.
And then she'd get off that phone, and she was in a different place.
Hmm.
When she would have trips down there, she'd come back, she was an absolute wreck for days, and was a different person, had large blocks of memory loss from the trips. And that's where, you know, finally, you know, unfortunately too late. I kick myself daily on this, that I did not see, I did not, you know what was going on. I finally cut off contact with her father, and that's when the recovery started. It was once we could isolate, get her away from him, and the control that he had, that she was finally able to start to break free and start to come forward with these memories. I mean, literally, she was 47 years old, and he had been there with some level of control throughout her life.
Yeah. My God. And do you know, you know, how many different individuals, basically, that you, I mean, can, do you know if one is able to, you know, then in this process program, you know, different types of personalities or even multiple, I mean, is there any, you know, end to this, you know?
No, Dr. Ross and other experts as well, I've read so much material on this, in this area.
Yeah.
And you can have somebody that's got, you know, a few personalities. You can have somebody that's got, you know, up to 100 different personalities. It really, and the longer it goes, this is why these people start to be like, you know, walking corpses. They can't function in life.
Yeah.
You know, my wife is a very attractive woman who is very intelligent. But, you know, she tried to keep this, I guess, appearance of perfection. She just, she would never laugh too much, would never yell too much, was never, you'd never get deep emotionally. She couldn't reveal anything because of what was going on. So she was kind of this walking robot that just, you know, at least when she was around us, that's all that you really saw. And from time to time, you'd see something deeper. You'd see this glimpse of a person trying to get out. And in our instance, I can tell you, as she started to integrate, that's when the memories are coming back and she can actually put it all together. She actually worked through some of these personalities. There was one personality that was absolutely rageful. This is a woman that never yelled. And when she was in this personality, she called me by her father's name once and actually attacked me. She would yell and scream and just was angry beyond anything that I had seen. And it was literally working out all this built-up anger that had been unable to come out. She, when she would start to go back in time and talk about the memories that she suffered, I'm telling you, she was a little girl personality. Demeanor, the manner in which she sat, the way she looked off and talked, cadence, everything about her voice was that.
Yeah.
She, you know, had a very cocky, confident personality that knew everything and was very bold in telling me what had been done and what she had done, almost as if she was a part and parcel of this, that she enjoyed what was going on. And it was very scary stuff.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm
not somebody, I'm a criminal defense attorney.
Yeah.
I've been, before that, a prosecutor. That's what I've done in my life. I did not have any background in this area. And even though I dealt in criminal justice system, I had never come across a case like this.
Yeah.
And so it was very, very strange. But what I saw was a woman that was trying to work herself out of this. And, you know, for me, fortunately, I heard about her child at first, which made me very understanding then about the things that she revealed later, you know, about our kids. That was the only reason that I was able to stand by her. I mean, somebody that has gone through this, you know, just horrific. And the satanic stuff, I believe it is just another mechanism for a smart perpetrator to be able to carry out this crime. See, you got to look at this in a simple sense. Dr. Sidney Seema is a child rapist. He's a criminal, just like, you know, a normal criminal. He doesn't want to get caught. Now, the thing about, you know, a good doctor here is that he's a bright guy. And so, you know, when he figured out through his training that, hey, I can actually, you know, deliberately create multiple personality. I can actually create an amnesic wall through the infliction of trauma. What a great way to avoid things. And the satanic abuse is just a step up from that.
Yeah.
I mean, think about it for a second. If you've got a father that's powerful and, you know, just, you know, in the most simplistic programming, if you say anything, I'm going to kill you. Okay, I mean, for a lot of people, that's pretty much enough right there.
Yeah, exactly.
But if you go through this other kind of mind control programming than he did, and then take it a step further, you do some more acid during satanic ceremonies, that child is taught that not only do you have to fear, you know, Sid Seema, you got to fear demonic. demonic forces and other spiritual entities that exist. And, you know, for a child who keeps that child thought as she grows older, that is a formidable wall to get through for her to reveal things.
Of course.
And it is additional trauma. I mean, you know, the type of things that she described in those settings. And it was a very few times, you know, overall, and the number of times that she was molested and raped, this was a very small percentage. But when she recalled those events, it was just, you know, in some ways I wish I had a camera on it, you know, but you can't do that. You can't invade that at the time. You have to just be there for her.
Yeah, of course.
And she relived this, and it was just, it was startling.
Yeah,
and it's startling the amount of detail that she gave and everything else.
Yeah. So, I mean, who in the end here, okay, this is obviously isn't, you know, finished yet, but I mean, who do you think this guy is really, Sydney? I mean, is he a lone nutter, so to speak? But or is he, you know, part of something more? Do you know that, you know, he had connections with other people within the military, for example, or other organizations?
I definitely think that he's part of a larger group, and that's part of the reason my concentration is so focused on him. Many times, people like yourself, myself, and other people that follow this, we want to do something, and it almost becomes a little overwhelming because, you know, as we talked, you know, last week, these things are all linked, and you start really getting deep into the problems that flow from this. So one of the challenges is to maybe concentrate on one area that can lead you step by step to exposing other things. And in this case, this is what I would say. He is part of a group that's been taught this, and as from what I can gather from my ex-wife is that he was part of a larger group of other individuals that are like-minded. Now, that makes a lot of sense. People that have these kind of depraved lusts, it's like a drug. At some point, you got to step up, and you continually have to step up. And what Dr. Seymour did was he got himself in a group of people that were of like mind, and therefore there was swapping of kids. They were able to trade off and be in this lifestyle together.
Yeah.
We know that the military has trained people to have this capability, and we would be naive to think that some people wouldn't want to use it for their own self-interest.
Yeah.
And I think that once you pull the weed, which is Dr. Sydney Seymour, up, you're going to find a lot of different roots, a lot of different people connected to that, very prominent people that are involved in the molestation of children. And then the questions will start tumbling out.
Yeah.
What kind of backgrounds do they have? And what you're going to find are these people that have been trained up in the ability to manipulate the mind, to try to get people to do things that they would not otherwise do.
Yeah.
And that's where it gets pretty scary, that we've got people that are doing this.
Yeah.
For a more jaded view, you know, let me say something. You know, our government took the people that ran this program to task because they were doing things illegally and unethically. Dr. Colin Ross has a book called Bluebird that deals with this, about psychiatrists and government agencies deliberately creating multiple personalities.
Yeah.
The unethical actions of these people is just unimaginable. So if you've got a group that basically, they don't have a whole lot of conscience. In fact, and I'll tell you right now, that's my opinion of the CIA back then and now. They're just thinking in terms of, well, we want to be able to do things militarily. We want to have control over people.
Yeah.
So we need to do experiments. One of the experiments that was brought out on public record was back in the 60s, the CIA actually set up prostitution houses and hired prostitutes, and then they set up the rooms with two-way mirrors and cameras to film things. They would bring these unsuspecting Johns back to the place, and they would dose them with LSD because the CIA at that time had a real interest in finding out what effect LSD would have on people.
Yeah.
They were thinking about trying to use this once again for extracting information or for some military use.
Hmm.
Now, if you had told me this 5 years ago, I would have thought, come on, this did not happen.
Yeah.
But on congressional record, that has been brought out. So if you have people that are of that mind, and then you've got a Dr. Sydney Seymour that they know is molesting kids, is doing these things,
yeah.
Isn't that interesting information for them? How far can you go? Doctor, what happened? tell us what happened.
Exactly.
I mean, if you've got no conscience, then, you know, they're just thinking, well, you know, the ends justify the means. If we can find ways of manipulating people and we have some test subjects that, you know, obviously wouldn't be legal, but we can do these things and get information,
yeah,
so be it.
Exactly.
If you're involved in you know, these kind of projects and programs in to one extent or another, which were not legal, you know,
yeah,
we've got evidence that Dr. Sidney Seymour was involved in biological warfare testing,
yeah,
when it was absolutely illegal in 1982 in a town called Indio, California.
Hmm.
We have a witness that's actually in the federal penitentiary, was with the CIA, broke loose, then got jailed up. He came forward after hearing about our investigation and revealed to us that he'd actually worked with Dr. Seymour during that time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and his name's Michael Reconcito. He's, you know, get on the Internet and
yeah,
widely known and
yeah,
documented, somebody that's been in the intelligence community. And I was extremely fortunate to be able to have contact with him and for him to be, you know, literally brave enough to step up and tell me. And his description of him was that he's an extremely dangerous man,
yeah,
basically a man of no conscience, that at the time that he was working on a biological warfare things when it was illegal.
Yeah.
And they, you know, they liked Dr. Seymour for that. He was a man that had no conscience in that. And interestingly, Susan had told me before I had known any of this about what he had done out in Indio, that she was brutally reprogrammed during an incident in Indio, California. And that was part of the reason we were looking at Indio, to try to substantiate some of her claims.
Hmm.
And what we found about that town during that time period was, it was basically just a black op city. It was basically CIA run. It was out in the middle of nowhere, 20 miles east of Palm Springs. And anybody that's not familiar with that, it's in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the desert.
Okay.
And they had people locally that were basically running things. And they were doing different experiments on our Indian reservations, because that way they were not held to federal or state law.
Oh, my
and,
God.
That information is documented up and down through newspapers, yeah, and books. You know, they're doing munitions, testing rail guns and other things, and then shipping arms off to the Contras.
My God.
And it was in,
yeah,
this setting that, you know, my wife, before I knew any of that,
yeah,
started talking about an incident where she was brutally reprogrammed in 1982 in Indio, California. And
yeah,
that's what spurred our investigation there, and that's what we found.
I mean, do you have any... do you know if Susan ever went on, you know, like, how should I say this, you know, kind of like missions or you know, did anything for the military like an agent would do? Do you know?
She was not used for that purpose. I mean,
okay,
what Dr. Seymour did was, you know, he just used what he learned from the military for his own depraved, sick,
okay,
desire.
I see.
And,
yeah,
and so that's what it was. But him using those mechanisms, you know, that's how he was able to pull off, basically, you know, have her come down and visit.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking they're just having a nice little family visit, and I'm up here doing work, and things are done, and she comes back up, and she doesn't say a word.
Yeah.
You know, the stories on that are just horrific, the things that were done, and
yeah,
I think that part of, you know, what he's about is shock value, to do things almost on the edge of being caught.
Yeah. And this opens up, you know, this area here that we are talking about opens up a whole lot of questions, because, you know, as we talked about last time, you know, basically the Manchurian Candidate, like the book, like the movie, you know, that describes, you know, a president under this kind of, you know, mind control, hypnotic almost. And I mean, according to yourself and after all the research you have done, you know, do you think that it could be a possibility, you know, that, you know, prime ministers, world leaders, politicians, whatever, you know, are could be, you know, under this spell, so to speak, this mind control?
Well, I'll tell you, that door certainly is one that is open. Dr. Colin Ross says the Manchurian Candidate is not a myth, it is not a theory, it is absolute reality.
Yeah.
And in our papers out here in the United States, when Al-Qaeda has given their taped statements, when Bin Laden has given taped statements, it,
yeah,
has been reported that they have scrutinized those tapes to see if there was any programming to trigger off sleeper cells.
Yeah.
So this is something that is absolutely acknowledged by our government. And I know probably thinking, boy, this is just nuts. Mm-hmm. But, folks, it's not. And if you'll spend some time looking at it, it's there. And it's so important because you've got people in high positions that have a desire to control other folks. And if this started off with a good intention, it has not ended up that way.
Exactly.
And when you think about the ramifications of this, it's just, you know, it's startling. One of the things that we found that was probably their dream weapon is basically a DNA selective bomb, and that is a biological warfare weapon that would basically wipe out one group of people and not another.
Hmm.
And that is something that Mike Reconcito has spoke about, I've read about, and Dr. Seymour actually was involved in some experiments on wheat fields where they actually were able to splice in and change the DNA of half the wheat field. So you have one wheat field, DNA is spliced and changed. They then spray it with a pesticide, which is basically your bomb. Half the field dies, half the field lives.
Yeah.
And what we've found is that, let's say, you know, you had Europeans, you know, battling, you know, with Arabs to make it ethnic-specific, gene-specific, DNA-specific. And that's the type of thing that once you allow this type of mentality, these are the type of things that they start thinking about.
Yeah.
And, you know, the point of all this is that what we've got to do is, one, just start pulling in our government and saying, no more. You can't do these kind of things, and you can't do them secretly. You can't do them on unwitting participants.
Yeah.
And we started to. Here in the United States, in the mid-70s, we took a little step. And then it's almost as if the public got scared and said, well, I just don't want to hear about this.
Turn away. Yeah. Amazing. I mean, how we talked about this last time we talked again, but you know, how deep does this go? I mean, how far spread is this? I mean, this is like an organism that has taken an own life, and as you said, you know, because these kinds of abuse and molestations continue within families and continue to spread, it almost like, as you said, like an own organism that has taken its own direction, and now basically we don't stop it because we refuse to acknowledge that it's there.
I agree 100%, and this is why, once again, if we want to do something good, if we want justice to be done, then I think the concentration is, let's start helping victims of child molestation, child rape, of sexual abuse, of incest. If we can stop that, one, we're going to be helping a great number of people.
Yeah.
Two, I think that you're going to start finding people like Dr. Sidney Seymour that have been trained up, and you're going to find out that they're involved in a lot of other things.
Yeah.
But let's just talk about the child molestation for a second. It grows exponentially, and if you start off with people that have gotten bold, and, you know, incest has been around, unfortunately, for a long time, but you know, smart perpetrators have now found some very sophisticated ways of being able to try to get around this. If you look at that, let's just take the Seymour family, for example. You have Sidney Seymour, father. He has five children. He does this to each of those children. They have grandchildren. All of a sudden, it exponentially starts to grow.
Yeah.
If these people are not gotten to, if they are not given help, they are going to allow their children to be molested and harmed. And then what happens with those children if they are not reached? And the thing that is just overwhelming to me is the degree of silence, the degree of fear that these victims go through.
Yeah.
There is a fear that is just overwhelming. I mean, for Susan to have gotten to the point where she went to the police and reported this and then to recant, that's the type of fear we're talking about. 47-year-old lawyer who had the fear of a 5-year-old.
Yeah.
You got to remember what he did when she was 5. In one instance, he actually took a puppy of hers and gutted it in front of her with a fish knife and said, "This is what I will do to you if you speak."
Hmm.
He had a pet deer, a wild deer that was a baby, a doe, I guess, I'm a city guy, and was around the house, and the kids were taking care of it, and they'd feed it and would come back, you know, at a regular time. At one point, Dr. Seymour seen this, shot the deer and ordered his wife to cook it, said it's just venison. the type of things that he would do. And think about the impact that has on a child.
Yeah, of course.
The thoughts of that man. That's the kind of, those are the type of hurdles that we're trying to get over to get people to start to open up.
Yeah.
They are petrified. And sometimes I think if you've not been abused, it's hard for us to understand the level of fear that these people have.
Yeah.
Dr. Ross talks about it. It's that fear that will cause someone like my wife to walk hand in hand with me for a year on this issue, go to the police, confess, and then 2 days later turn around and say, no, none of this happened. It was because my husband beat me. My husband forced me to write the diaries I wrote.
Yeah.
He forced me to confront my father.
My God. So, yeah, basically, let's...
And Dr. Ross testified that, believe it or not, that's normal. Now, if you told me that before, I would have thought, come on.
Yeah.
But he has dealt with this in hundreds of cases. That's what the fear will do to these people.
Yeah.
And so we've got to make a world that is much more accepting of what they've gone through, much more comfortable to talk about this. And that's where I've kind of screwed up sometimes. Sometimes I just want to bluntly jump in there and talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, try to urge victims to come forward. And, you know, boy, you gotta have a soft touch.
Yeah.
I'm just hoping that overall, if victims know there are people that care about them and that there is safety, then you know what? They might start to come out more. And
exactly.
If we can recognize the signs of those people that may not have spoken about their abuse because it's stored away, if you look for the signs, then we might be able to direct them into the proper counselor, people like Dr. Colin Ross, that will start to address this and really start to get them healthy.
Exactly. And because it feels like sometimes, you know, what we really are fighting against is, you know, people who just refuse to believe that this is real because they have, seen enough, you know, conspiracy debunking movies or whatever, you know, and people just can't, you know, it is almost like, you know, that their own trauma, barrier takes a defensive step and protects even people from recognizing the possibility that this might be true.
I agree 100%, and I think it is also our comfort levels.
Yeah.
I just don't think that a lot of people, as they're walking through life, watching TV, going to movies, going to a restaurant, and all the rest of it, it's like they want to be in their own little bubble, and they don't want to realize that these things are going on.
Exactly.
Here's something that I've got to point out.
Yeah.
This shouldn't be a shock to anybody. My story shouldn't be a shock to anybody. For the last 2.5 years, I've been charting other sexual cases. Just out here in California, we had in my county, there was an individual that was convicted for having sex and filming it with his infant child and sending it off. Mm-hmm. There's an individual in San Jose, California, that is probably one of the largest number of victims that agency has ever seen. But they found a book where he had kept the numbers of these people, and it was just overwhelming.
My God.
Europe, they prosecuted 66 people as part of a ring of sexual molestation.
Yeah.
All you have to do is open your eyes and look. Now, interestingly, the media many times will come out and they'll have a splash and announce the case, and then they kind of die away too.
Yeah.
So, you know, that does affect the public. But if we open our eyes, we'll see that this is a problem. And incest has been a problem that, you know, something that people have not wanted to talk about for a very long period of time.
Exactly.
But I would say back in the 80s is when, you know, there has been a change where people have started to say, wait, the numbers are staggering.
Yeah.
Right? Children that have been molested, it's 1 in 4. 1 in 4. Incestuous acts, that's the majority of those 1 in 4 incidents. And what we've got to do as parents, as just people that care about the planet we live on, we've got to look for these things and make sure that they don't happen and provide a safe place. I mean, we don't allow, cannibalism, in a civilized country. I don't know how we allow people to think that they can use the children that they gave birth to as sex toys, sex objects.
Yeah.
It's sickening. And it's time that we, as a world, just put our foot down and say, no more.
Exactly.
We're not going to do this. And we're going to provide a safe place for these victims.
Yeah.
And we are going to go after the people that have done these things. They're cowards. They're like cockroaches. As soon as the light comes on, they scatter. And we should not be afraid of these people. The only power and control they have are over children or over people that they have, you know, basically mind-controlled all their life.
Yeah.
But otherwise, these people are cowards.
And if there, sorry to interrupt here, but if there is enough of us who are aware and are able to, you know, spot the warning signs in good time, we don't even need to, you know, go after people anymore, because everyone will be, you know, aware of this and keep their eyes open, basically. That's the point.
You know, I don't want to sound naive or anything else, but, you know, I pray often for a world where there is no more child molestation, where we're going to look back at it and say, remember that thing? God, you know, can you believe that that ever existed?
Yeah.
And I believe that if the main thing that will accomplish that is a society that is extremely open and supportive of victims, and that is there for them, and, you know, and as an active part of treatment, we have counselors and psychiatrists that are trained up to deal with this area.
Yeah.
And this is something, you know, when you look at it, it's really been a fairly short period of time where there has been an emphasis on this. And like I said, I think you can chart it back to the 80s. So you're talking about 20 years.
Yeah, exactly.
That's 20, 25 years where this has really gotten off the ground.
Yeah.
You know, I look to people like Dr. Colin Ross, who has really stepped out.
Yeah.
There were some people that you know, didn't believe that multiple personality disorder, you know,
exactly.
It's now called DID, dissociative disorder, identity disorder.
Yeah.
Now. Yeah. And it's just a different name for it. And it is now a recognized state and condition, you know, a treatment area that needs to be treated. And we just need to do more in that regard to get that out and help these people. Because if we don't, it's going to continue on at an exponential rate. And that is something that, you know, should terrify most of us.
Exactly. And we got about, you know, 2.5 minutes left here. But, you know, tell me a little bit about your case. How is it going? You're having a hearing coming up here soon, I guess.
Yeah, what happened, we went to trial, and interestingly, they had 18 counts plus, they're called sentencing enhancements, and several lesser-included offenses. And the bottom line is most of the specific claims that Susan had made against me, and they were very bizarre, and they had to be. She had to have something that was extreme enough to overcome all these confessions and diary notes and everything else.
Yeah.
The jury found me not guilty of on the specific claims.
Yeah.
She claimed some very bizarre things. We had 10 not guilties and then 6 sentencing enhancement not guilties.
Mm-hmm.
The strange thing on this case was, you know, it was a long case. There were a great number of counts. And we have found that there was a group of four jurors that were very against me and have committed juror misconduct. And we're going to be having a hearing about that and hopefully getting a new trial on the remaining counts, because they did, the jury compromised and found me guilty of torture. Now, they were not told what the sentence was. In our law, they're not allowed to consider that. And torture, believe it or not, has a very broad definition that really was poorly written here in California and can encompass a great deal of conduct.
Uh-huh.
The jurors, when they were interviewed afterwards, said that they felt that these four jurors were really pushing for that. The four jurors, even though they disliked me greatly, had to concede on the other 10 counts and 6 enhancements that I was not guilty.
Yeah.
But they hung in there and basically got people to compromise on that count. Now, when we've interviewed people, they said, well, we just didn't think it was going to carry much time. And once they found out it was life, we've had a number of jurors come forward and say they absolutely don't think that that should exist. Two jurors have signed affidavits saying that they felt pressured by this group. They felt that I was not guilty, and they just are beside themselves because they felt that they were pressured into voting guilty.
Yeah.
So it was just one more ironic step in a very bizarre case.
Yeah.
It was so strange hearing these not guilties, which was so good and vindicating me in so many ways, many things that had been written about me that I had to suffer through.
Yeah.
I was acquitted on. And then we got to this torture count, and nobody thought that, you know, we were going to get had on that.
Yeah.
And they found me guilty. And then
that's
I've had years, you know, like I said, sign affidavits.
Yeah.
They felt they were pressured.
Yeah.
So what our next hearing is going to be about is hopefully the judge will reverse the torture count and actually give us a new trial so we can finish off what we started. And we believe that if we do this again, that there will be no, their case has been virtually gutted by the not guilties.
Yeah.
And if they're to try to do this case again, that I think we're going to be victorious across the board.
That's great. That's good news. And we have to, we're totally out of time here, so we have to end it, Richard.
All right. right.
But I want to thank you so much for telling us about your case here, and that we could, you know, stay in contact and let us know how things are going, and maybe we can do another show down the road here.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah.
That'd be great. I just keep up the good work, and I thank everybody that has given support. And just, you know, if you're thinking about this case, you're doing something good.
Exactly. Thank you very much, Richard. Stay brave.
Right.
Bye-bye.
Okay.
Hey.
Bye.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. Remember that next week we will continue with our series with Michael Tsarion, so tune in live if you want the opportunity to win a DVD from his Origins and Oracles series. Bye-bye, everyone. Thanks for listening.